is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be views of Mr. Brent Winters, who is a lawyer certified to practice the law, but he's going to be talking this evening about the common law. Now, most Americans really don't know much about the law. It's sort of like, well, you go to the hospital, you're in the hospital system, and you sort of go along with the system. You don't understand how it works, but you're there, and you expect to be taken care of, and usually you are, one way or another. When you get into the law situation, it's very much the same. We have a constitution, but do our courts really believe in the constitution? We notice that the flags in our courts, they all have a gold rim on them. They're not regular American flags. They all have this gold braid on them, which to some people suggest they're admiralty courts, and admiralty law is entirely different than constitutional law or common law. And so, basically, of course, admiralty is sort of like when you're in the Navy and you're at sea. Why, the admiral, the head of the ship, really has the life and death right to do whatever he wants to. That's the way it was in the old British Navy. Admiralty law was different than British law. And, well, let's find out what we can about common law. The common law, which was at one time the foundation of American law, and we seem to have sort of lost that, so I'm going to learn this evening, and I hope you will as well. Brett, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Welcome. It's great to be here.
Well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this, and you've written a book on it, and I haven't been able to get hold of a copy of the book yet. I'm looking forward to getting one, but tell us a little bit about your efforts, your book, and what's the difference between common law and admiralty law and regular law and constitutional law?
Well, you make an excellent comparison that's apt to our circumstances, and it's also apt to the Declaration of Independence, although the Declaration of Independence doesn't state admiralty law expressly. That was part of the problem. We discovered that the admiralty jurisdiction was being invoked by the King of England and the colonies in order to remove the right to trial by jury, because admiralty courts, being civil law courts, are like military courts. Roman, I say civil law, I mean the old law of Rome that originally came out of Babylon and was codified later by Rome. They did such a sophisticated job, but it's good for military organizations and conquest of territories, and like you said, ships at sea where obedience to orders must be efficient and quick, and no toleration for disobedience. But admiralty jurisdiction extended into among us folks out here is a bad thing, because it takes away our liberties and destroys our prosperity and our ability to be productive and satisfied people. I say satisfied more than happy, because we aren't always happy, but we can be satisfied in our efforts. But common law gives us that opportunity, and it is different. A comparison that draws the distinction so well. Again, I'll start where I began, is admiralty law, which is a military kind of law, and common law. Admiralty law demands immediate obedience to orders. Common law, and the will of the commander is important in civil law, and admiralty law is a form of civil law. But in the common law jurisdiction, where we live here, it's not the will of the state, the will of the commander, the imperial will that controls its relationships, that control. And when we look at, for example, our common law legal digest, like Anjur, we see it's categorized according to relationships, husband, wife, creditor and debtor, trustor and trustee, lendor, lendee, and we categorize relationships and we protect relationships freely entered. There's our freedom of association.
Hold on, folks. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Brent, go right ahead.
Oh, are you still there?
Yes, go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I make that point that your comparison is a good one to draw the distinction for folks who want to see immediately get a handle on what the difference is. And without comparison and contrast, and scholars of the common law, common lawyers have said this for centuries, the only way to understand the common law is in contrast to what it isn't.
All right.
It isn't civil law.
Common law is not civil law. Now, what's the difference between is civil law, admiralty law?
Admiralty law is a form of civil law. These are just names, of course. It's been called different things down through the centuries. For example, divine right of kings, which was a well-known phrase back about the time and before our country began. That's a phrase that denotes civil law. It means that the will of the king is paramount and the king is above the law. But common law, of course, doesn't say that. Common law is, I like to use the word not consistent, but consonant with the scriptures. Law is above all men and all women and all governments because, as the Bible says, God says of his word that he has elevated it equal to or above his name. In other words, God honors his own word. He keeps his promises. And we're to honor his word and his promises also, and those are tantamount to law, the way things are.
But is this, certainly in the law as we practice it in the United States today, I mean, certainly originally, of course, the law was based upon the Bible, Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, which were based on the Bible, but how did we get away then from God's law in our churches, in our courts to where we are today?
Well, Satan works incessantly and tirelessly, and he's extremely he knows his craft very well, and he works through people and he orchestrates, I believe, and I think the Bible bears this out, and I think the words of Christ bear it out, that he orchestrates his will, and he sets the state up as ultimate. And the will of the state becomes paramount. In these little counties in Northern California, not maybe the cities, you can't see it as well because there's so much confusion, but in the rural counties of America, I'm using this as an example, a picture maybe, to draw the difference. The county courthouse was the center of government. And people, when they thought of the government, they thought of the courthouse. They didn't think of the administrative building somewhere away from the courthouse. They didn't think of the Social Security system. They didn't even think of the legislature, because the legislature wasn't ultimate.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with all of our... All right, well, Brent was simply talking about this concept that the common law is based upon God's law. And initially, our country was founded as a Christian nation. In other words, we adhere to God's law. Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England were the foundation of all law in the United States for many years, probably for a century. And Blackstone, if you read Blackstone's laws and commentary on the laws of England, it was all about the Bible. But then, of course, as Brent says, Satan really got into this, and Satan is not an abstract idea. Satan is a very real force. He has his agents working certainly at every level of our country and every level of our government and every level of our courts. And then they begin to modify the law. Would that be a fair statement, Brent?
Oh, yes. I was enjoying your lecture.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm saying you're saying things that I agree with, and the county courthouse used to be the center of our law because in our common law tradition, justice only occurred on the individual level, on the relationship level. Justice wasn't a matter of what the state wanted. Justice is truly a matter of how do I deal with my neighbor, and as we know, Christ divided all of the law of God into two categories, love God and love your neighbor, and the first five commandments deal with man's relationship with God, including the fifth commandment about honoring your parents. Well, they stand in the place of God when you're a child. And then the second five commandments deal with man's relationship to man horizontally. And the relationships are what make the common law, not the will of the state. And the state is there to protect the government is there, and the common law tradition to protect for relationships freely entered. Again, it comes back to freedom of association. Our founders knew, and when they codified, I shouldn't say codified, that's not the way to say it, but when they drafted the Constitution, that was a re-expression of common law principles of government and law, and freedom of association is right there at the foundation, right in the First Amendment. It has to be. If we can freely associate, we can be productive people. And I don't think anybody would argue with that. But when the state steps in, their will becomes paramount, and I'm not allowed to associate with who I want to, or disassociate, to put it on the other side of the coin, with who I don't want to, my common law liberties are being violated, and production suffers. Production and, again, satisfaction. I mean, I'm talking a lot. I'm so filled, I'm about to burst, and you ask me a few questions. I'm afraid I go off in too many directions at the same time. But let me emphasize one thing, Dr. Stan. The common law is not a list of laws. It's a way of approaching the problems that bob up from the flux of human relationships. And the common law only deals with what happened in its purest form. It does not deal prospectively. Legislation and legislators look ahead and they decide what they want to do with society and they pass laws, not knowing what's going to happen in the future. Pure speculation. The common law is a matter of the courts and individual justice and for juries, by the way. We don't want to forget that. We go in front of juries and we determine facts of what did happen and then we decide what the law is of that particular relationship. It's a particular justice. And yes, is what I'm driving at. And before I get off going too many directions, maybe I should stop and allow you to guide me. Maybe there's something you want to talk about.
Well, of course, recently I was called down to at least be appraised as to whether I would become a juror or not on a case. And it was a litigation case. It was an accident case. Somebody hit somebody else with a car. There was no question about that. The really question came up as to the compensation for medical care and physical therapy and all of these things. And as the judge said, and of course he's sitting there in his black robe, he says, "Now, you know, we don't want you to be concerned about the law. We don't want you to go into the law library to look up on the law at all. The law is what I tell you it is. And now, of course, then I will tell you what the law is, and you will, of course, make your judgment based upon what I tell you. And certainly, is there anybody here who can't go along with that?" And I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, Sidney, don't I have anything to say? If I'm on the jury, why do I have to do what the judge tells me to? I would think that the jury would determine what's right and what's wrong. You know, but of course, we can't even know what the law is. The only thing we can know is what we're told. Now, is that sort of like an admiralty court in contrast to a common law court?
Yes, and it's one of the fascinating points of our tradition that after 1,500 years of juries, and probably longer, we just don't know because we don't have records, juries in our common law tradition, going clear back to the Saxon tribes and maybe even beyond, we just don't know. But anyway, going way back, we still haven't settled that simple question of whether juries have power or authority to disregard the law. And I say, I've settled it in my mind, and I listen to you, I think maybe you settled it in your mind, although you didn't come right and say it, and other people have. But as a matter of the declaration of the courts, what courts usually do is they'll say, the judge will say, I'll tell you what the law is, you decide the facts. And then they say, then you come to a conclusion. And Lord Mansfield set the rule that we still go by, and he said this. He said, jurors have the authority to decide the facts, but they do not have the authority to decide what law applies. But, he said, they have the raw power to decide, and if they do, there's nothing anybody can do about it. And that's what we've really done all these years. What we need to do in America, in my humble opinion, Dr. Stan, is somehow we need to train people, children, when they're coming up, what a juror is and what his duties are, and train them that they have to understand what their authority and their power is. We could call it both authority or both power. It doesn't make any difference whether we think it's authority or power. Bottom line is, jurors have the right and the responsibility to consult their conscience as we find it. We bring them in off the street. I was fascinated, maybe you've heard of this fellow named G.K. Chesterton.
Right, sure.
he was an Australian. He's been gone for a number of years now, but he wrote a book called Tremendous Trifles, and he told, just like you did, of an experience when he was called as a juror. He said, why is it that we have juries? And he said, it's not because police officers and judges and prosecutors are all bad people. He said, some of them are good people. And he said, it's not that they're stupid people. He said, as a matter of fact, some of them are very intelligent, learned people. But he said, the problem is they just get too used to it. And he says, if we want to catalog a library, we go to the expert. If we want to find a new galaxy, we consult the scientist. But he said, if we want to decide whether somebody lives or dies, we grab the 12 nearest people on the street and ask them. And that's really what a jury amounts to. But then he added, if I'm not mistaken, that's what the founder of Christianity did. He took 12 people, and Jesus, I'm glad you're seeing it the way I did. Jesus took 12 men that the world didn't give much credit to, but he knew that they were made in the image of God, and they were just as worthwhile and intelligent as anybody else, formal education or no formal education, and he knew that they could come to the right conclusions about things if God's Spirit guided them. And even if people aren't Christians, Dr. Stan, I believe that the Bible teaches in Romans 2:14-15 that they can determine what's right and what's wrong. They may not be able to apply it to themselves consistently, but if they're sitting in a jury, they can decide. And a thief sitting in the jury will be able to recognize a true thief. I really believe that that's what the Bible teaches. I had a guy tell me one time, he made the point, I hadn't thought about it, when David, he broke the last five of the Ten Commandments in reverse order. He coveted, lied, committed adultery, and murdered Uriah. He stole his wife, you remember the story. But when Nathan the prophet confronted him, he told him that story about the lamb, and he said the rich man had great flocks, and the poor man just had this one little lamb. But when the guest came to the rich man's house, instead of the rich man going to his massive flock and taking a lamb for dinner, to slaughter for dinner for his guest, he took the poor man's lamb and slaughtered it. And Nathan the prophet, you know the story, said to the king, King David, well, what should we do? And the moral indignation boiled up in him, and he was as sober as a judge when it came to judging the other fellow. He knew exactly what right and wrong was. And he said, that man, and he swore an oath, and it was a righteous oath. He said, he must die. And then Nathan said, you are the man. So it doesn't take a sinless man to know what's right and wrong. It does take a man guided by the Spirit to do it consistently. I think that's taught in 1 John. But the common law, this is the point I'm coming to, Dr. Stan, is the common law tradition works because every person born of the race of Adam is made in the image of God, Christian or non-Christian, and therefore the Bible says he has the ability, to discern right from wrong in specific situations if he'll apply his mind to it, if you can get his attention. And the common law system, the common law tradition, is founded on that idea. The civil law tradition, by contrast, is founded upon the scholar legislator, who is set up as higher and smarter and better logicians than everybody else. And they, by pure logic, can come to conclusions and speculate about the future and pass legislation, whether it be a legislature of many men or just a dictator who legislates. But he's set up as more intelligent than the rest of us, and therefore we must do what he says. Those are some of the differences. I struggle, like even men like Dean Pound, who was a proponent of the common law, and you read his books, and to understand what the common law is, a fellow just has to get his head going in it, and pretty soon you begin to get a feel for it, and there are some major principles, and they're in the Bible also. But the trouble is, Dr. Stan, if I may just make an observation about application of truth, we can learn what the Bible says, but how do we get it over into our courts? And that's the connection we're not making. We're not making, I don't think, as a country, we're not making a connection between what the Bible says and the courts, and the principles that we call the first principles of the common law are in the Scriptures.
Okay, of course, at one time, when you went to court, why you put up your hand, you said, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. They don't do that now. You just swear, but you don't swear to God. It seems like we've taken God out of our courts, and when we do that, of course, we give ourselves up to terrible, terrible problems.
We give ourselves up to the enemy.
And the devil. Of course, now, does common law really exist in our country today? In other words, these concepts, or are we all in administrative or civil courts? Certainly, if I were to go to court tomorrow... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and people say, well, you walk into the courtroom and there's the fringe on the flag, or there's a no jury or something, and people say, well, there's no common law, but of course, and some of those, there may be truth to some of that, but the common law doesn't exist or not exist because of some symbol. The symbols may not be good, and they may be negative, and they may give the wrong spirit to things, but bottom line, when I walk into court, even though I recognize that the judge is biased and he hasn't told anybody, and he's colluding with the prosecutor or one of the attorneys, and the clerks are helping the judge collude to send some poor guy down the river and violate his rights. Even in the midst of all that, there's a form that's followed, and that's a common law form. For example, Magna Carta says, Magna Carta talks about the law of the land. And that phrase goes back to King Alfred, and we even have documents from about 600 A.D. when Alfred was, he died about 600 A.D., but just before that, we have land deeds and things, and that phrase is found, the law of the land. And by the time we get to the United States Supreme Court and they're interpreting that clause, because it's in the Constitution, too, the Constitution picked it up, the law of the land, our Supreme Court has said over and over that that phrase refers to due process of law. And the old Anglo-Saxons, in England, where they called it the common law, which they did for interesting reasons we could talk about maybe later, but the old common lawyers in England, to them, due process was more important than substance. In other words, the substance of the law, you shouldn't murder your neighbor, you shouldn't bear a false witness, you shouldn't steal from your neighbor, that's substance. But the process is different. How do we go about discovering and uncovering the truth that Romans tells us very clearly is buried in unrighteousness? In a common law tradition, we have trials. We go to court, and we fight openly and verbally, and we cross-examine witnesses. You go to South America, that doesn't happen. You go to France, that doesn't happen. You go to Germany, that doesn't happen. Thailand, Russia, China... It doesn't happen. All those jurisdictions are under the old Roman code or some form of the old code of the Roman Empire. And they don't try cases like we do. And when we try a case, we believe, as I believe the Bible teaches, that the process that we follow, if we follow the right process, we stand a better chance of uncovering the truth than if we just do what the state says, which is the civil law principle that's followed. And we call that process due process of law. And when I go into a court and people say, well, there is no common law in the courts. No, it's still there. And if it's there in anything, it's still there in the process. And if you get your rights are violated at the trial level, we still have some process left. We can stand up in court and say, I demand, Your Honor, an unbiased judge. I've discovered that you're biased, and I'm making a motion that you must recuse yourself immediately. Well, see, that's process. That's not substance. That doesn't go to the merits of the case, but it gets rid of the judge, and you may get a fair hearing. And they've been paneled the jury, and you notice that everybody on the jury is a Presbyterian, and you're a Methodist, just as an example, or vice versa. Well, you have a right to object and say, wait a minute, the process is being violated here. It has nothing to do with the merits of the case, whether or not I'm guilty or not guilty. But I just noticed everybody here is...
Hold that talk right there. Okay. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Brent Williams and Brent Winters. We're talking about the common law and how the law system works. And, of course, Brent is pointing out that we still have this framework of common law within our courts. We may certainly not like it, but at least we have an opportunity. We can have a lawyer. We can question our accuser. We can have, you know, the opportunity to present our case to the jury. You don't find this in most other countries. Imperfect as our system is, is. It is still based upon certain concepts that go back, probably, at least to the Magna Carta, and even probably before that, this idea of a jury of your peers. And of course, you can always complain, as Brent was saying, if you're a Presbyterian and all the people on the jury are Methodists, you can say this is not a jury of my peers. Of course, I heard one time when a lawyer was on trial for something or other, and he said, well, look, there's no lawyers. I want all lawyers on the jury. Those are my peers. But so this can get to rather an absurd situation, and yet we have to have a fair and impartial jury that certainly can hear that case, and at least we have the opportunity to do that. But one of the things, Brad, is sometimes, many times, the judge will not allow things to be brought in, would tend to prove the accused innocent, and he will not allow that material to be presented.
I agree. It's a problem, and the judge is traditionally, in their common law tradition, are gatekeepers of evidence. And trials, the law of trials is the law of evidence. And the judges have great discretion there, and in my opinion, maybe a little more than they should. I'm of the opinion that the jury is entitled to a lot. I mean, if they want to know something, then they're entitled to find out. A grand jury, for example, is entitled to know anything, and the laws of evidence really don't apply as a practical matter, and of course, the attorney for the accused isn't even allowed in the grand jury room. It's all the prosecutors in there, and the grand jurors don't understand that their authority is higher than the prosecutor in many cases. And as the Hyde Commission said, a grand jury with a federal prosecutor with a grand jury could indict a ham sandwich.
Right.
That's their conclusion. So our people that are called to jury duty aren't of independent mind. Now, that brings me to this. What is the foundation of the common law tradition? It can be expressed in many ways. One of them is this. The common law tradition depends upon every individual being absolutely independent of mind. That means the judge, the attorneys, and every juror involved in the process. And as you and I know, what we call independence of mind is really total dependence on God and God alone.
Well,
we need. Without any mediator between God and man except the man Christ Jesus. In other words, the state, the church, the preacher, the pope, nobody comes between the individual and God according to the scriptures. And that kind of, we call it, I say again, independence, but really it's that individual exclusive dependence upon one's creator that enables true thinking. You know, Van Til, Cornelius Van Til, he said a lot of good things. One of the things he said was, the scientific method is no more than thinking God's thoughts after him. And that stuck with me for many years, because God's thoughts, sentences as we know are complete thoughts, and God's righteous sentences are written in his word, and to follow that word is to follow the thoughts of God. And as you know, the people that have done so much for us in the scientific world have been people who have been committed to following the thoughts of God. But if a juror... It only takes one juror of independent mind to deny the state its will with an accused. And the jury, the one lone juror has the will to say right, or the power to say yes to the state or no to the state. Another principle of the common law. Common law is not a majority rule institution. But more than that, and I got to hasten to add to this, Dr. Stan, it's not a republic either. There's a vast difference between the common law tradition and continental Europe, what we call Western culture. Their culture is different. Majority rule is not part of the common law tradition. That's why the jury is not a majority institution. And that's why one lone juror can nullify a jury verdict. So there's just a lot of things like that that I try to point out, and I do so in my book, my book is available at www.commonlawyer.com. Commonlawyer.com, and also there's a phone number there you can call if you're interested in the book. And I've taken time to lay it out. I wrote the book because I had to. I was driven to write it. Somebody said once some people write books because they want to. Other people write books because they have to, and I had to get it out, and so I got it out. And I feel a little better, but I still can't contain it all. The subject swells in my hands, and the fear I have is that I'll, as I said a while ago, I'll talk too fast and say too much, and You know, you don't dump the whole load of hay on the cows all at once. You give them a bale at a time. And I afraid maybe I do that sometimes. But
well, I think it's important.
I get the impression. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's so important that people begin to understand and think about a legal process that, unfortunately, is being corrupted. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Brent Winters, and we're basically talking about the common law. And we'll be certainly people are calling in wanting to know the name of the book. Why don't you just give the name of the book and the telephone number one more time?
Name of the book is Excellence of the Common Law. Excellence of the Common Law, and it's a comparative law text between the common law tradition and the Roman civil law tradition. But Dr. Stan, there are only two traditions in the world. But before I go on with that, I'll give you the website, www.commonlawyer.com, and there's a telephone number there, and there's contact information.
Oh, why don't you go ahead and put that telephone number out for us?
217-549-
Mm-hmm.
4050, well, that's 549-4050.
Now, well, we'll see if we can get our producer to put that up on the screen here so we can have that again. And, of course, one more time, the telephone number.
217-549-4050.
549-4050. Okay, fine. Well, I think, Chris, are you in the engaged in legal practice? Whereabouts are you practicing today?
Well, I practice in Illinois, and I've practiced in federal California and Oregon, and state courts and appellate courts in Oregon and Washington. So I get around a little bit, but I practice some criminal defense. Mining law is where I started. I used to be a geologist, I still am, I suppose. I shouldn't say I used to be. But that's one of the things. Mining law is one of the things that got me interested in the common law. I was in the mining business, of course, and mining law is uniform throughout the world. And, for example, the tin binders in Cornwall in England for centuries operated their own courts, criminal and civil jurisdiction, without interference from the crown. And still do, by the way, and they're also the miners of the coal-bearing regions in the escarpments in England. There are different areas that operate their own courts without interference. But mining law in America got its real development in California, and the men came here. They formed mining districts. Of course, there was no government. They formed their own mining districts, set up their own criminal and civil courts, and the rules of property ownership, et cetera, and then those... The decisions of those small district courts finally wound their way to the state courts of California and wound up in the Supreme Court of the United States and were ratified there.
Okay, are you there? Brent,
yes, I'm here.
Okay, go right ahead. A little interference there. We'll be back.
That's right.
And, right now, of course, I want to tell our listeners that our guest this evening is Brent Winters, and he is a lawyer. He's written a book on the excellence of the common law. That's the excellence of the common law. And, of course, his telephone number to call if you want to get any more information, 217-549-4050. That's 217-549-4050, and of course the website is www.commonlawyer.com. That's commonlawyer.com. Our telephone number here is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-800-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question for Brent, well, of course, we hear lots of things that talking these people will tell us that, oh, my goodness, now you certainly don't want to, you have to, if you really want to, of course, be independent and free of government control, why you actually write your name all in capital letters, something of that sort, and you certainly don't want to take out a deed on your property, of course, that puts it under the control of the government, and and you don't want to get a marriage license because that puts everything under the control of the government. And we hear all this talk about, oh, certainly we can take cases to court, and if we just adhere to these concepts of common law, why, of course, we can win every time. What about things like this? Is this important? What about how important is the gold fringe on the flag in the courtroom?
Well, actually, I think that gold fringe is awful pretty. I used to be a sailor, and I was on a warship, and I remember some of those things, and it makes me feel patriotic. But there is some truth to the idea that civil law, and admiralty law is one of the forms of civil law, is creeping in on us. Administrative law is the other form of civil law that's probably even more dangerous than admiralty law. Admiralty law has its place. You know, the admiralty law is taking a grand jurisdiction over vast areas of the United States through the wetlands legislation. I grew up on a farm back in the Midwest, for example, and, you know, we spent our lives filling old wells and old ponds and ditches and trying to make land farmable and cleaning up brush and all that. But now some of those places that we tried to clean up, the federal government, not the state, the feds have come in. And under, by the way, the Admiralty Clause of the United States Constitution and taken jurisdiction over holes in the ground that are maybe moist part of the air. That kind of thing, that's Admiralty jurisdiction creeping in on us. And of course, they have a jurisdiction, the Admiralty Clause gives the federal government jurisdiction over navigatable waterways. Well, the Supreme Court has said that navigatable means waterways that can be made navigable. Well, that takes in a lot of little creeks. Maybe if you could navigate it with a canoe, traditionally, that was a navigatable waterway. But now it takes control over things that the Army Corps of Engineers can dam up.
Hold that for just a moment here. We're having a little problem with our board. Let's see if we can get that back. Okay, go right ahead, Brent.
Well, so Admiralty jurisdiction is moving in on us that way, and then they take control of the tributaries, and they take control of the drainage basins, and obviously, the Constitution wasn't intended to encompass all that. People used to make fun of Justice Joseph Story. He was the youngest man to ever serve on the Supreme Court, and by the way, he was a champion of the common law. But he wanted to extend the power of admiralty jurisdiction, and one of his... that if somebody came into the courtroom with a bucket of water and threw a corn cob in it, he'd take admiralty jurisdiction over the bucket and the cob, which was his attitude. He thought it was a strong jurisdiction, but certainly he wouldn't go as far as the federal government is attempting to go today. Of course, the admiralty jurisdiction had mostly the idea of the Constitution's admiralty jurisdiction was free intercourse on our waterways so that our commerce would flow between states and internationally on the high seas and things like that. That's one form. The second form of dangerous civil law that's creeping in on us, and it's even more dangerous, is administrative law. Administrative law rose out of Rome, but it reached its zenith in France during the French Revolution. And what all administrative law is just the will of the state is paramount to all other things. And, of course, that takes in a lot of regulations, and it denies us the access to courts. People say, well, we're so happy in America. And my response to that is, no, we aren't, really. As a matter of fact, if we were doing what the common law tradition allowed us to do and what we ought to be doing, we'd be settling our differences in courts and not looking to the government to resolve our problems for us through administrative law and administrative tribunals. If we have a problem with our neighbor, instead of going to the county board with it and our neighbor is dumping trash on our property, we would bring an action against our neighbor for some kind of tort or trespass. And there's plenty of common law actions that can be brought. And we'd settle our differences. It's the privilege of people like us live in a common law country, a common law tradition, that we can go to court and fight with our neighbors and settle our differences. And get closure, not have to be in perpetual hatred with one another. But the truth is, Dr. Stan, our courts aren't available to us. There's not enough courts, and it's impossible to get into a real court with real judges. And we opt and settle for administrative law at administrative courts where the state's will is paramount, and we're just forced to do what they tell us.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, is it possible to get a fair hearing in our courts today? Sydney, we always worry about that sort of thing. You know, what about if the judge is in collusion? Certainly, very often we see innocent men sent to prison because the prosecutors are withholding information. And yet, of course, the thing is that, you know, the prosecuting attorney, in a civil in a criminal case, he's never held responsible. When he violates the law, he holds information back that should be made available to the defense that would have exonerated the individual. How can it be that prosecuting attorneys are not held, for violating the law and sending innocent people to prison? We've had so many instances of this happening, certainly over in San Jose, close to where I live. Why, of course, there was one prosecutor over there. He was winning all the cases, but he was winning them because he was withholding information and distorting evidence and withholding evidence. Isn't he responsible for what he does? And how can you have government officials who can get away with committing crimes, whereas, of course, the average individual can't?
Well, fundamentally, to come back to the difference between common law and civil law, is that we've got too many government employees. And prosecutors, by the way, professional prosecutors are not, most emphatically not, part of the common law tradition. And they're relatively new arrival on the scene, even as late as the 1980s, and I don't know what the arrangement is in England today, but in the 1980s, in England, there were no professional prosecutors. The Crown, when they wanted to prosecute somebody, they retained the private attorney to do so. Professional prosecutors, professional investigators, all those things are not a part of the common law tradition, and what they do, of course, is they put a hammer in the hands of government that's too big, and then people want to justify their positions, and they want attention, and it grows a bureaucracy, a criminal law industry. I ran for Congress back in the Midwest in the last decade, the last century now, back in the 90s, and of course I go to political meetings, and I'd sit at the front table because they'd ask me to say a few words after the meal, and I'd usually sit next to somebody in state government, because there are a lot of people in state government, of course, any states you go to. And one of the people I got to know was deputy director of the prison system. And nice guy and all, but I was chatting with him one time, and I said, "Boy, you fellas are building a new prison in this state about every year." I said, "When I was in grade school, we all us kids knew all the prisons in the state, and there were only about four, and, you know, you just name them off. But I said, now they tell me they're up to about 30, and they're building a new one every year." He said, "Oh, it's terrible." He said, if we continue at the present rate of incarceration in this state, by the year 2024, half of our citizens in this state will be in prison and half will be out of prison, looking in. I said, well, his name's Larry. I said, "Larry," I thought he had the answer. I said, "What are we going to do?" And he said, "I don't know." Well, what's the problem? Well, one of the problems is we're putting a lot of people in prison that aren't dangerous. That's one of they're just maybe objectionable because we don't like them, or we don't like the way they look, or the way they act, or something they're involved in, or who their friends are, and they've conspired, we say, with somebody or something. But at some point, it all has to end, and there's so much power in government that it's overwhelming us, and they're justifying their position by prosecuting people, and as you pointed out, it's not like they're all honest. I have to say, I've been in a lot of criminal cases. Some go to trial, some don't. But I shouldn't say that in every case the government twists the truth, but I always expect them to. Because Dr. Stan Bishop Ryle said, he was an old Anglican maybe 100 years ago. He said, men at their best are still men at best. It doesn't make any difference who's in the position of prosecutor, and investigator, and police officer. They're humans, and they want things to go their way, and they're certainly going to be biased to their point of view. And if they don't just tell outright lies in a criminal case, they're certainly going to present the evidence in the best light to the government. And the government has unlimited resources, and the poor guy who's accused has very few usually. And if he's assigned an attorney, that poor attorney who's assigned to him is so overloaded with cases, there's no way he's going to help him. I've seen this over and over again. I don't say that I have all the answers, but I do say this, that judges or prosecutors, professional prosecutors, are not part of the common law tradition. And judges, by the way, in the common law tradition, are from the private sector. They're taken from private practice, not government service. If you go to South America or France today, for example, and you find a judge, all those judges are educated to be judges. They get civil service jobs when they get out of college or law school, whatever the system demands where they, in the country where they are, and they start their way up through the civil service ranks. And they have one, they're trained to do one thing, and that one thing they're trained to do is to ensure that state legislation, the will of the state, is enforced. Now, our judges, in the common law tradition, we say that that's not the job of the judge. We say that the branches of the government are separate and equal, that the judge makes his decision of independent mind. And I heard somebody say on the, it was a conservative talk show on the radio, and they said, it was here in California, they said, what are we going to do with these out-of-control judges? Well, I agree. There are some judges out of control. But I got upset and I called in. And I said, out-of-control judges, do you have some suggestion who you want to control these judges? Of course, we don't want the legislature to control the judges, legislature to control the judges. We don't want the governor to control the judges. I mean, the foundation of our common law tradition is that judges aren't controlled by anybody and they are of independent mind. We say things that aren't consistent with our tradition, and we, in doing so, we give people license to maybe destroy our liberties. And so that's my passion is that people would understand our common law tradition. It is not a democracy. It is not a republic. It is a republic's a form of government, by the way, and we maybe resemble that in some ways. But at bottom, the Constitution, the blood and the backbone of the Constitution, is the common law.
Now, of course, I think to really, you ask, of course, who can control the judges, who can control the court. If people are not responsible to God, you're not going to have justice. It's just that simple. You cannot depend upon you.
Bottom line, it can't happen.
You cannot certainly depend upon, men, because all of us are prejudiced one way or the other, and if we're not answerable to God, we're going to do what benefits us individually. And that's the big problem, I think, that that we have in America today, is because they take God and prayer out of our schools. When they did that back in the 1960s, the Supreme Court knew they were going to destroy the moral foundation of this country. They took, of course, God out of the pledge when we actually go ahead and we swear to testify the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And then, of course, we don't say, so help me God. They've removed the Ten Commandments from our courtrooms. The concept of this nation under God, you remove God from a country, and then you enter with moral anarchy, and you wonder why it's happened.
Well, yeah. And the gravity of the oath, we've lost it. The oath is foundational to what we do, and the very use of the oath in our courts is the badge of our sin. In other words, as Jesus said, say yes, let your yes be yes, your no be no, and that's good, but we want an extra assurance, and we want people to put themselves in the hands of God himself, that they'll tell the truth, and then we can rest on it better. But as you mentioned before, people get up and they affirm, or they say, yeah, I swear, but they don't have a clue what they're doing. They don't know what they're swearing to. They don't know what swearing is.
How can you swear if you're not swearing to anybody? I mean, what in heaven's name does that oath mean? Somebody just called in and wanted to know. So certainly, of course, when you go into a courtroom and certainly we talk about our courts, there's a little wooden railing there. There's a little gate you go through. And you go, of course, through that gate. And then, of course, whether it's the court, the judges up there, or maybe the Board of Supervisors up there with all their legal advisors. Is there any significance to going through that gate? Does that have any symbolic significance or legal significance?
Traditionally, that's the bar.
Right.
And it's a bar. It's like a bar. It's a little railing goes along there. And those that are privileged to argue orally before the court can go up there. And then if you're you have a case, you're a court. So traditionally, that's what we say a member of the bar. That's some who has, in England, they're called barristers, and in Australia and Canada, they're called barristers, and here in America, we just call them lawyers.
No, but really, that little railing there is what they call the bar, and that has a significance. Bar. Does it have any legal significance, or is it all symbolic?
Well, it's all symbolic, and but if you go up there and you aren't licensed to practice and you're not one of the parties before the court, the judge could hold you in contempt. I mean, a lawyer, I was in court in another state once and in federal court, and I didn't have my paperwork filled out, and you got to get permission, even if you're an attorney someplace else. And I sat behind the bar, and my client was up on the other side of the bar talking to the judge, and it was U.S. He finally said, well, his attorney is here, and the judge just looked up and said, come up here right now. Well, of course I did. He told me what to do, and he was willing to give me permission to come up. And but that bar is significant for that reason. It provides a division.
All right. For instance, in our local community, why, of course, the Board of Supervisors hold their hearings in a courtroom with a bar there. Do they have any significance as far as the locally elected Board of Supervisors sitting behind the bar? Does that give them any additional power?
Well, I would not. It's not judicious anyway, as a part of the judicial branch.
All right.
So, of course, they have authority by virtue of their position. I mean, they can set the rules, I'm sure, but in our courts, it's an ancient symbol. It goes way back to after the Norman Conquest. Just after the Norman Conquest in 1066.
All right, fine. Well, our guest, of course, is Brent Weathers. He's a lawyer. We're talking about the common law. My telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'll welcome your calls, certainly when we get back here for the second hour. It's an important subject. I think most of us are intimidated. We need to learn a lot more about the bar, as it were. Well, this is Dr. Stan Drench. You've got 3 more minutes in this hour, and then we'll go to the next hour. But how would you like to wrap up this hour for our listeners?
Well, just to say that common law is not a list of laws. This is what I see with people who are really sincerely interested in the Constitution and our legal tradition, and it's people are telling them, promoters are telling them it's a list of laws. It is not. It's a way of uncovering truth, and that way of uncovering truth in the common law tradition is due process. And due process, I didn't mention this a while ago, but I want to do it now, most fundamentally defined is notice and an opportunity to be heard. You know, the common law tradition arose out of chivalry, chivalrous behavior. And if somebody challenged somebody to a battle, trial by battle, they used to call it, and the one party showed up and the challenged party didn't show up, the one that did show up won by default. Well, the same thing's true in court today. But if you give the other side notice, and they don't show up, they defaulted. But you're required to give them notice, or you don't get that default. You don't get that win. You tell them they've got an opportunity to come in and answer and be heard. We went from trial by battle to now we have battle by trial, and that's the common law tradition has taken on the rules of chivalrous behavior. We go to court in America and in other common law jurisdictions, and we fight, and we believe that by fighting and by the struggle and the intensity of oral, and oral means public, and civil law traditions is mostly written and therefore non-public, nobody knows what's going on. Here it's oral, it's public, it's visual, and we engage. We look people in the eye, we look our accusers in the eye, we look our witnesses in the eye, we look at the judge, we look at the jurors look at us. It's intense. And we believe that through that intensity, we stand the best chance of uncovering truth, and the common law is constant with Scripture and holding that the truth is seldom on the surface, as it says in Romans 1, that it's suppressed in unrighteousness.
Well, I think it's so vitally important, of course, that we have moral people. If you don't have moral people, the society isn't going to work. In fact, it was John Adams who said, our form of government was made for moral and religious people. It would not work for any other. Why? Because, of course, if you did not have people who could govern themselves and look after themselves and determine what was right and wrong, then you were going to have an all-powerful government. And the wonderful thing about America, at least initially, was the power of government was limited over the lives of the people. Our founding fathers realized that liberty and limited government were synonymous, that tyranny and total government are synonymous, and what have you sort of forgotten that? as government moves to regulate every aspect of human endeavor. Thanks very much. Hang on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family. As you know, we have now over 65 outlets every week. Of course, a lot of those on our weekend program, certainly 35 stations get our weekend program. And, of course, our other programs are heard more early in the morning and afternoon, and then our evening program that you're listening to now. Your job out there, if you're in a position to help us, we'd certainly appreciate hearing from you. And certainly any sort of a donation or getting some of our products help us to stay on the air and to maintain what we have, because, of course, we're on shortwave. We have our satellite uplink, and you can listen to that 9 hours a day. Certainly by going to my website of RadioLiberty.com, you can hear Joyce Riley there for 9 hours a day. You won't get much accomplished if you listen to Joyce and I together, but the information is there. And then, of course, we have our internet links, our satellite, our shortwave, and then radio stations. We do radio stations because we want to reach people who don't even know there's a problem, and there's no better way to do it, in my estimation, cost-effectively than through radio. So if you'd be interested in helping us, our number 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free catalog, if you'd like to, and of course we'll send it to you a computer on a CD-ROM, unless you specifically request a written catalog. We, of course, have a regular catalog. We have a health products catalog, and then we have an emergency food catalog. And if you have not begun laying in your emergency food, you really need to. We are moving into a crisis situation. There are no food stores at all in this country at all. We used to have 3 years' supply of wheat. Now we have about 40 days' supply of wheat, and just hope and pray that some of the wheat crops come in, or we're going to be importing wheat this year, as well as so many other food products. Up until recently, America was a major exporter of food. We're no longer. We're an importer of food. Understand that, of course, if you believe the Bible and you have read Revelation 6:8, they talk about the rider on the pale horse, the destruction of a quarter of the population of the world. And how do they do it? Through war and through famine and through infection, through epidemics, and all of them are very, very real possibilities here. You're going to have to look after yourself. If you'd like a food catalog, an emergency food catalog, our number 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope that you have read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, and it explains to you who really runs the world today. And people say, oh, well, nobody runs the world. Yes, they do. In fact, if you read the Bible, you'll find that somebody's running this world. And in fact, certainly the prince of this world, the man who controls all the governments of the world, is the devil. And that's, of course, what it tells us, the mount of temptation, when the devil offered all the nations and all the kingdoms of the world to Jesus, if he'd just simply kneel down and worship him. And we are, of course, told we should be worshipful of our government. Our government all knows exactly what it's doing. Our government would never do anything wrong. We should go right along with what the government says. And no, we're answerable to God and not to government. Because I personally believe that there are powerful spiritual forces at work within our government today. My book, Brotherhood of Darkness, is so vitally important, but my talk on, and it's available on DVD with a syllabus, The Forbidden Secret, because there is a secret that's been up out there for 5,000 years. It's been passed down through the secret societies and the mystery religions. You need, of course, to get The Forbidden Secret. You need to get our talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that, because you've got to be able to find out if we're telling the truth, and all the documentation is there. You want to know about all the wars of the last century and why we're really in Iraq, the untold story, and the syllabus there is a must. If you want to understand why, for instance, the price of oil is going up, price of electricity, the value of the dollar is going down, you need to get our syllabus, Sustainable Development, the talk that goes with that, Sustainable Development, the Road to World Government. Because there, of course, we give you the documents from the other side that talk about how they're going to have to redistribute our wealth, not their wealth, but our wealth, and how they're going to have to lower our living standards. It's all part of a plan. Nothing is happening by accident. Again, our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need reminds of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this nation. They happen to be my views. And, of course, the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. Brent Winters, who's an attorney. And I want to ask Brent a question. Somebody had called in and asked if do you have to remove your hat when you're in the courtroom, or do you have to remove anything else? And, you know, when we go into the courtroom, why, of course, there's almost an aura there. It's something we feel a little uneasy. When we're all sitting there, and then the court recorder or somebody gets up and says, all rise, I hear the Honorable Judge so-and-so is coming in, and everybody gets on their feet. The judge comes in, walks in, and then he says, sit down. So you sit down, and you're sort of awed by this way this whole thing is. And of course, if you're going to be a witness in court as an orthopedic surgeon, I very often was a witness in court and a professional witness, and then you have to sit back there, and then you're called to come forward, and then of course you go into the witness stand, and you feel very uneasy, as if, well, my goodness, I could get into real trouble here. And of course, what you're supposed to do is just be honest and straightforward, and the lawyers are not supposed to coach you, but I find very often, looking back, how often the lawyers, for instance, the plaintiff's lawyers would come to me and tell me what the issues were, and of course it was very obvious how they wanted me to testify. Can actually the lawyer actually tell you what to say, or try to influence what a witness is going to say for a plaintiff, things like that, Brent?
You don't want to do that more than that. If you do, you don't want to get caught, that's for sure, but... Yeah, the witness needs to be left alone, and no, they're not to be coached. And all these things are done sometimes through hand signals. I've seen people try to do all sorts of funny things, and it's sort of torch justice. It shouldn't be done. I would want to add, though, people, we do walk in the courtroom, and there's a gravity there, and we sense it. I, for one, because I like to read about our tradition, I like to understand it, and experience it, and it's a joy for me to walk courtroom and to give extra respect to the court, and because in civil law jurisdictions that doesn't happen. The court doesn't amount to much in the civil law jurisdiction, because the courts, as I said before, are just maintainers of the state's machinery. They're there to enforce the will of the state. Their job is a civil law job. They're dependent. Civil law judges are dependent upon for the position and for their pay from the state. We like to say our judges are. For example, the Constitution says that the pay cannot be diminished during the Supreme Court justice's tenure in office. There's a reason for that. That is not true in civil law government. Judges in civil law states are not free, really, to challenge the government. And they're not an independent branch. They're not an independent office. So when I walk into a courtroom in America, as I often do, it's a joy for me to say, Your Honor, because in civil law countries, they don't say Your Honor. They don't get that respect. And to when the jury walks in, we all traditionally in the common law country, we stand up when the jury walks in. We stand up when the judge walks in. Out of habit, we should. We give a measure of devotion that way. Not devotion, but of honor. You know, Jesus made the point, and he was quoting the Old Testament, when he said, ye call them gods, quoting the book of Psalms, speaking of the magistrates of Israel, gods with a small g, Elohim, but not the Elohim, high Elohim, but with a small g. And the magistrates of Israel, the judges, were to judge, Scripture tells them and admonishes them, to judge the judgments of God. But at the same time, they are, as Blackstone says, the common law is auricular. Well, also in Israel, the law was auricular. That means it was oral. The judges delivered oral decisions.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, you were saying that the decisions were oral. That, in other words, they were given so we could be heard. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, because everything is oral because it's public in a common law tradition. We don't. Yeah, we write things, but it's but because it's oral, the public can know what's being said, and then we can all write heard on because the judges know that we're watching, and the bailiff knows we're watching, and the clerks know we're watching, and that everyone's watching. It's everybody's responsibility, and that's why courthouses should be open. They should be places where there's lots of light, and these things are all important. You know, we're whole persons. We're not magicians like in the civil law. We don't depend upon the scholar to tell us what the truth is. We go into court and we engage the whole being. And, you know, there are only two legal traditions in the world, Dr. Stan. There is what we call the common law, and then there is the civil law of the Roman Empire. There is no other tradition of law and government on the face of the earth. We call it Roman civil law because Rome has taken it to such a high sophistication. But truly, it's the law that came out of Babylon, and Nimrod is the one who first organized the civil law into a system of law and government that made a total state. And in those early days, we can read the scripture, and then we go through Greek mythology, we learn that the city is the foundation of civil law. In other words, when Rome conquered a territory, they always built cities. And those cities were miniatures of Rome from where the law, the civil law of Rome was extended, the administration. When Pharaoh in Egypt, in the book of Exodus, it says he built treasure cities. And those are old English words. What they mean were centers of military and might and military might and administration, administrative law, where the power of the Pharaoh was extended over a territory to extend his terror everywhere. The common law arose from an agrarian, agriculture, a farming community, by contrast. And then the farming community property rights are tantamount, not the rights of the state. You know, in the civil law tradition, Egypt, Babylon, Rome, Pergamos became the center of Babylonian religion, of course. Then it came, Babylonianism spread from there in a big way. It's a religious and a government system. But in those systems, the state, Dr. Stan, is total. We've all heard maybe of Carol, a lot of us heard of Carol Quigley, and he points this out and does a good job of it in some of his writings. The total state is what made Nazi Germany. You know, Germany and Saxony were common law places until Bismarck. The Roman, the law of Rome never got there until
Bismarck. Top would be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Brent was just talking about Professor Carol Quigley, who had written his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and some of his other writings, pointed out the difference between civil law and common law. Of course, Germany was a common law country until, of course, Bismarck came along, and, of course, Bismarck in the 1870s, somewhere in there, and beginning to bring in all these changes in society, and they eventually began to make the state ever more powerful. And, of course, this is the situation that Adolf Hitler came in with, an increasingly all-powerful state. Of course, he was initially not elected to office. He certainly, I think, got 40% of the vote, but he got Hindenburg, who was very, very weak and ill, and he turned then the power of the state over to Adolf Hitler. till, and Adolf Hitler, of course, first of all, you know, began to become very aggressive militarily. They moved into Alsace-Lorraine, into Austria, and then they held votes, you know, elections, and the people overwhelmingly supported Hitler, because why? He was giving them pride in their country. They were very, very depressed at the unfairness of the Versailles Treaty at the end of the First World War, and he was beginning, of course, to get the economy moving, create a stable currency. Everybody had a job, and the Germans were proud of the Alsace-Lorraine. Never was a German protectorate. It always had been, and suddenly it had been taken away by the Allies. Now it was back under their control. They had taken away the Austrian people. The Austrian people, most of them wanted to be part of Germany, because I don't think they understood the implications of Nazism, but suddenly... even the city of Danzig was a German city in Poland, and those people wanted to be affiliated with Germany. And so Hitler was fulfilling the hopes and aspirations of the German people, and at the same time, of course, he was increasing his rule over their lives. And of course, because he was getting tremendous help from people here in the United States and from people in Great Britain who were encouraging him and financing him, because, of course, they wanted another war, and I think Hitler was certainly not adverse at all to that idea. He wanted, of course, to join with the West in a campaign against the communists in Russia, but that was not at all what the people in England and the people in the United States had in mind. And so when Hitler actually eventually attacked Poland from the West, and Russia attacked Poland from the East at the same time, what did the West do? Why, they went to war with Germany, and they allied themselves with the Russians who'd attacked Poland, and yet it was because of Poland, supposedly, the war came about. But we're getting way off the subject of common law. Let's get back to Brandon. What was the point you were trying to make for our listeners about how the law began to change in Germany with Bismarck?
Well, I think that you were right on point. You were on the subject of common law, and all chaos that you were talking about, and I was listening intently, learning things. It's obviously something you understand a lot about, but I was listening intently, and I noticed is it was a lot of chaos, and all chaos came out of the civil law finally getting its grip upon the German people, and during the days of Bismarck took the code of the Roman Empire, made it even more comprehensive, and dubbed it with a new name. He called it the Code of Bismarck. And that enabled the power that Hitler eventually got, because just like in the Roman Empire, the state is total. And in these countries that have civil law today, which is most of the world, they don't say, well, you have to worship the state. Some of them, by the way, do. North Korea does, by the way. You know, the only public worship that's allowed in North Korea is of the dictator. And that's true in some other places of the world, too. But they may not say it, as in France, but as a practical matter, it's true, and here's how we know it's true. Just like in Germany, and just like in Imperial Japan, which took on the Roman code before World War II, to obey the state is a complete defense to any crime. So when we had the war crime trial, we conducted the war crime trials in Germany and in Japan after World War II, the defense of all the German officers, soldiers, and sailors, and the Japanese officers, soldiers, and sailors, was that we obeyed orders. And that we, of course, didn't accept that. One of my professors years ago was a prosecutor at Nuremberg. He's long since deceased. His name was William Franklin Fratcher, and I credit him for giving me an interest in this beyond what I had. And he said the first question after World War II, when they went to the trials at Nuremberg, the prosecutors, and he was an army prosecutor, a young captain, they had to decide what law they were going to prosecute the Nazis under, just like they did in Japan. They had to decide, were they going to prosecute them under the Roman law, or the law of Germany, which is the Roman civil law, and the law of France, and the law of Russia, or were they going to prosecute them under the law of the United States, England, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand? And they finally decided they had to prosecute them under the first principles of common law, because if they prosecuted them under the civil law of Rome, which was their law, they would have all been exonerated of the crime, because their defense would have been, you can't prosecute me for obeying the greatest authority on earth, which is the state. But maybe you remember, Dr. Stan, back in 1968, a young lieutenant named Callie in Vietnam. And he was accused of ordering the massacre of about 100 Vietnamese civilians. And he was court-martialed. And even in our court-martial proceedings in America, we followed common law principles. And as General Marshall said, after World War II, when some of our boys were tried for war crimes after World War II, men being men, and he said that if our boys plead obedience to orders, he said that can be a point of consideration for the jury. But he said obedience to orders of our Americans cannot be the sole exonerating fact. In other words, it comes back to this, Dr. Stan, we were talking a while ago. Every American soldier and sailor is individually responsible to make his own decision and to do what's right regardless of orders.
Yeah, but of course, unfortunately, you can be put in prison for refusing an order, even when it's an unjust order. Of course, Callie actually said, I was just carrying out orders from superiors. And of course, what was really so terrible about that was that Richard Nixon pardoned him. And a lot of us, I don't have to admit, I supported the Vietnam War, at least initially. We were all relieved, of course, when Callie was relieved of his responsibility for the murder and the rape of so many citizens. And believe me, Callie joined into the rape. If you've ever read Seymour Hersh's description of what happened there as he talked to these men a decade later, it really sickens you to think that American soldiers could have done that. You can understand their mentality, but that doesn't make it right. You do not kill innocent women and children and rape the women. American soldiers there at My Lai raped those women, and then they killed them. And they were exonerated for it. That was the amazing thing. The President of the United States, using his power, actually pardoned Callie. And, mm-hmm. And what was even more disturbing is that many Americans, myself included, were relieved when he did, because it was actually then that tended to suddenly justify the war, and we could do whatever we needed to. We had to win that war, and of course we never went there to win the war. Well, let me getting off on other subjects, but I certainly share your concern, Brent.
Uh-huh. No, I understand. We weren't fighting for territory there, that's for sure. I don't know what exactly we were fighting for, but it was disturbing what ultimately happened. The trial itself draws a distinction between the common law mindset and the civil law mindset, and that is that every person responsible, even a young military man, though he may not understand, when he goes and takes his oath and he goes to boot camp, he swears to obey all lawful orders. He doesn't swear, as they do in Indonesia, to obey all orders. He swears to obey only those lawful. Now, that brings up a lot of problems we need to talk about, or something we don't need to talk about right now, but we need to think through, and everybody think through more. West Point graduate has thought through it quite a bit and writes about it, and he says, for example, the case must be clear-cut. In other words, he says ridiculous orders or meaningless orders or stupid orders or dangerous orders, that doesn't mean you can't disobey them. They must be unlawful, and that's a pretty high standard to me. In other words, it's got to be a clear-cut case, and so we don't encourage people to disobey orders. That's not the point. But the point is, in the final analysis, everybody's going to answer to God individually for what they did, and that's the thing that drives us and their ultimate consideration in all these circumstances. Like Jesus said, if the Roman soldiers come along and they tell you they're tired of carrying their backpack and they throw it off on you because you're handy, and the law says you got to carry it a mile, a Roman mile, carry it 2 Roman miles. If it doesn't hurt you, it's not against God's law to do that, so do it. And that's the attitude we should have. But at the same time, there are those circumstances, and I think it's important that we're all aware of that, because if we aren't, we will violate God's standards, and then we'll suffer the consequences for it.
Well, I think that it's so important people understand the law. We're sort of awed by this whole thing. But what about the Constitution? You know, certainly we have a Constitution which should be the law of the land, but in so many of our courts they seem to totally ignore this. In other words, whatever the state wants, whatever the judges want, and they really don't seem to care about the Constitution. Doesn't the Constitution determine the law in our local courts as well? And what right do we have to appeal on those specific issues?
Yes, it does. And as I said a while ago, that without the common law, the Constitution doesn't have much meaning. For example, it's important to understand the common law principles. The Constitution guarantees the right to try the jury. And that's pretty much all it says. It doesn't describe what a jury is. It doesn't describe how it's to be chosen. It doesn't describe the functions of a jury, things like that they're not to be questioned in any other place, and all those kind of things aren't elaborated on a lot, because the people that were reading the Constitution, the Supreme Court Justice Hughes, for one, has said this, the people that drafted the Constitution, the men that drafted it, and the people that were going to read it, were enamored with the common law. They understood it, they knew it, they lived by it, they fought the revolution over it, and that should be said more often. And they explained why, but they understood it so the Constitution is a statement in brief of all the common law principles of government they understood, but now...
Hold on, Bob, we'll be right back in just a moment. Okay. All right, Brent, go right ahead.
But but our population doesn't understand the common law, so they have nothing in their consciences to inform what they're reading in the Constitution. It doesn't mean what it should to them. They don't understand it, so... Behind the Constitution are the principles of the common law. For example, as I said a while ago, freedom of association, the common law is about relationships. And it's about freedom of association. And that, therefore, is put in the First Amendment. It's not just something scratched off because it's a good idea or somebody liked it or it's convenient. No. That's the foundation of the common law tradition, the freedom to associate, and the freedom to disassociate if one wants. And when we let government encroach upon those things, we destroy the Constitution. Why don't we understand the Constitution? The state court judges respect it, largely because they don't understand the common law tradition. And the common law tradition, by the way, is not taught in our law schools. For example, you were mentioning a while ago Blackstone. This is the interesting thing about Blackstone. Blackstone, obviously, was a great common lawyer. And by the way, Blackstone had a degree in Roman civil law. He understood the difference, as few men did, and he made his choice intelligently, and he said the common law, our liberties depend on it. And of course, he did his lectures there at Oxford. Common law had been kept out of Oxford because universities are Roman institutions, and they're designed for scholasticism, and they were designed to propagate the Roman civil law, and they're all models, all the universities in Europe are modeled after the University of Bologna. I call it baloney, but it's is that the way you say it? It's an Italian word, but I've never been to Italy. But I think that is the way you say it, baloney, and that's where the first civil law university was, and Oxford was fashioned after that, and the common law was never taught at Oxford until Blackstone delivered his lectures there, and then the commentaries rose out of that. But Blackstone says in his commentaries, Volume 1, Dr. Stan, that the common law of England does not apply in the American plantations. He was talking about the 13 American colonies. Of course, he published his books, his four volumes, about a decade, 1865, before the Revolution.
That would be 1755.
Or, yes, 1765. 1765, thank you. So he published them right along there, and he said the common law doesn't apply. Now, he really believed that, as did many common lawyers in England, and as did the majority of people in Parliament. Of course, then, on the other hand, Blackstone stood up in Parliament and argued against the tea tax and the Stamp Act. He thought those things were oppressive, but Blackstone taught that the common law was for England and England alone, it wasn't for her colonies, and Parliament had full government control over the colonies. In other words, legislation controlled the colonies. Well, the funny thing is, I say it's funny that Providence works this way, Blackstone's commentaries sold by far more copies in the American colonies than they did in England. And the people latched onto those commentaries and they said, this is ours. This is our heritage. This is our law. This is the way we do things. And England, of course, attempted to deny the mother country, deny the common law to the American colonies, and that is why the revolution occurred. We characterize it in different ways. You know, for example, when they came to Concord, Lexington, they were looking for the Americans' guns and their powder. They wanted to deny them the right to bear arms, and they fought over that. Well, that was a common law right, and as Granville Sharp said, right to keep and bear arms, there never was a time when individuals didn't have not only the right, but more than that, the personal, lawful responsibility. You had to do it for the security of their own nation.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Fred Winters. Well, this is Arthur Stamm. Our guest is Brent Winters, and we're certainly talking about how the common law came to America. And, of course, as Brent was pointing out, that Blackstone, who actually wrote commentaries on the laws of England, did not anticipate, of course, that the common law would be extended to the United States. It was to be primarily in England. He was, of course, a contemporary of Edmund Burke there at the time of the Revolutionary War. But, of course, it was these ideas of Blackstone and the commentaries on the laws of England, the foundation of common law, law based upon God's rule, that became one of the major reasons why we went to war, because the colonies were being denied access to the common law, and they were being denied access to the right to keep and bear arms. That was what the march at Lexington was all about. The shot that was fired heard around the world at Concord had everything to do with the fact that they were limiting the right of the American people to have weapons. Well, go ahead. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. What rights do we have when we go into court? And Cindy, you know, because they basically the judge gives orders ahead of time, which would prevent jury nullification. Do I, as an individual, have the right to address the jury and tell them, look, you have that right, not only the right, but you have the obligation to judge the law, not what the judge says it is, but the law as it is. And if you find the law certainly to be unjust or wrong, why, you as a member of this jury have the right to nullify that law, because your obligation is justice, not law. Can I do that?
You mean as a juror, Dr. Stamm?
No, as a defendant in a case.
No, the judge probably wouldn't let you get away with that. It's been tried in different times, but it is absolutely axiomatic, as the Supreme Court has said. I'm talking about the United States Supreme Court, that the history, the Supreme Court said, Justice Holmes speaking, history shines upon the instances that the jury brings in their verdict not only he put it this way, in the teeth of both the facts and the law. That's an old phrase that means contrary to anything anybody would think that had any sense. And there's a reason for the jury's verdict, and the jury doesn't have to say what it is. It may be something that nobody ever knows or understands. But certainly, the jury has that power. We can't say they don't. And what, nobody can do anything about it, and they will never have to answer for it according to our law. That's the common law tradition. You know, for a jury, we say the jury has the power to judge the law. What we really mean when we say that, they have the power to judge the application of the law in this particular circumstance. I mean, we should narrow it down to that. For example, you know, prohibition was back in the 1920s and 1930s. It was against the law for people to manufacture or brew beer or whiskey or any of those things. And, of course, that whole idea, they put in the Constitution of all things, and that, of course, grew, history shows us, it grew a federal bureaucracy of law enforcement that we still have, that's become humongous and expensive. Well, juries, I wasn't there back then, I wasn't born yet, but juries, I do know, reading history, case by case, over time, denied the enforcement of prohibition. Because apparently they saw that it was an impossible situation, and law enforcement was becoming overbearing, and they didn't like it. And case by case, they finally stopped it, and the whole thing was ended, and prohibition was repealed. Well, I just use that as a historic example of what juries can do, whether right or wrong. They do have the power to do that. People would argue, well, maybe that was wrong what juries did back then. That's not my point. My only point is juries have that power. But the common law steps slowly, like a man walking through a minefield. He tests every step as he goes. And he, we say in the common law that the growth of our understanding of what's right and wrong is a calculus, like a pearl. Every case that comes along and every jury verdict that is handed down expands the application. Even the law, Dr. Stan, never changes. Right and wrong never changes because right and wrong is in the mind of God. God has existed from eternity past to eternity future. And so what right and wrong is as eternal as he is. But the application of the law varies. Not, it doesn't change the law, but it applies in this situation, new situations come up. And for example, we have new technology today. We have computers and we have internet. Well, how does contract law come in to email and what constitutes a signature? Those are all things that we wrestle with in the legal community, and we've come to some conclusions about those things. But what I'm saying is the principle never changes because God never changes.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, our guest is Brent Winters, and when we get back, we'll welcome your calls. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question, you have a comment, well, I would love to hear from you because that's what talk radio is all about. And it's so important that people understand our legal system and understand that they can influence it if they're on the jury. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Well, Brent, I actually had an opportunity of interviewing a woman. I've even forgotten who she was, but she was sitting on a jury, and she felt that what the instructions the judge gave were wrong, and I've forgotten the details of this. But she talked to the jury about the concept of jury nullification, and apparently they'd ask her ahead of time if she would go along with the judge. She said yes, and then when she got on there, she felt this was just a total abrogation of rights, and so she eventually got a hung jury. I don't know whether a hung jury or what actually happened, but I know that the person that the government wanted convicted was not convicted. Somebody went to the judge and said, this woman, of course, talked about the fact that the jury doesn't have to go along with the judge's instructions, and they went after that woman, and they were going to send her to prison for daring to sit on the jury and to challenge the state. Well, eventually, against there was such an outcry from the people when they heard about it that the judges backed away, but they put her on probation. She had to spend a small fortune defending herself. So really, when you go on to the jury, if you really want to do what's right, why, you're laying yourself open. Wouldn't it be better not to be on that jury if they're going to come after you with all the force of the law if you dare to speak out in that jury room?
That's a good point. If you're going to do what's right, you're going to stand alone at some point. I think history teaches us that, and I think experience, after we live a few decades, we learn that. But nonetheless, it's just you and God on the Jericho Road, as the old song says, we're all bound to do the right thing and to walk with God. And if we believe it's right, we should do it, and we must do it. And everybody will benefit from somebody standing by themselves. But don't think you're going to have the crowd with you. You plow new ground, you plow alone. And I think this case you're talking about was up in Idaho somewhere.
Could very well have been.
I've heard about it recently. Maybe I saw it on the internet, but that is the kind of thing that's happening. But when you read English history going back a few centuries, and juries in England, the same thing happened way back then. And that's what I said at the beginning. We've never settled this issue. After all these centuries about the power of the jury, we're still fighting about it. We haven't come to a consensus. There's a good side to that. The good side is, as long as we're fighting, it's important to us. If we ever get to the point we're not fighting about it anymore and it just becomes one way or the other, then nobody cares. And that's not good. So, and this lady, if she really believed that she was doing the right thing deep in her conscience, and that's what it's all about, Dr. Stan. I think it's conscience. You know, the old story about John Knox when he was before Mary Queen of Scots.
Hold that thought, but we'll be right back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Brent Winters, and certainly we were talking about, this idea of somebody on the jury saying, I'm not going to do what the judge says. I think this person's innocent. The judge is telling us we got to convict them. That's what they did with the Davidians. I talked to the woman who headed the jury there, Sarah Blaine, and she told me that the trial of the Davidians, the wrong people were on trial, but the judge said we had at least come up with some sort of a conviction, some little minor thing, and then he sent him to prison for 40 years. And she felt very, very bad that they had come up with any sort of a conviction because they felt the wrong people were on trial and that the government was responsible for the murder of the 17 children and all the women and the men. And of course, you all had to go into the background of what happened at Waco to realize that the government was responsible, but the judge was not going to allow that to happen. Well, of course, we were talking about another case happened in Idaho where a woman was out of court, and the judge told him, gave him all the reasons why they had to convict the individual, and she actually took a stand in that jury saying this is wrong and that they had a right not to obey the judge but to do what was right as far as the individual. She was turned in by the other juries. They wanted to send her to prison for daring not to go along. And of course, I was just saying what a frightening thing that is if you're on the jury and you think that there's going to be a gross miscarriage of justice, doing what you think is really right rather than, of course, what you're told to do. And, of course,
I'm appalled when I hear stories like that. And I'm appalled that the judges would say things like that. I heard a federal judge not too many years ago talking about the accused and say, well, he didn't let him out on bail. And that's okay. That's his discretion. But then he said, anybody who would have done the kind of things you've done doesn't deserve to be on bail.
But, of course, yeah,
happened to, innocent until proven guilty. It's not like this is really complicated legal stuff that these judges are doing. They're violating fundamental things. And one of the things that surprised me about going into court, you argue such, it seems to me that just childish fundamental things, why should we be forced to argue things like that? And say, well, wait a minute, Your Honor. I think you're showing bias here. There is a principle, innocent until proven guilty. By the way, that's part of the common law tradition, too. That's not civil law states. But, yeah, I agree with you. Judges should be neutral, and they shouldn't try to influence the jury. And the jury should come, as I was saying a while ago, with their consciences, as we find them, at least. And I was starting to tell you about people say, well, what is conscience? And I'd like to tell a story about John Knox. He was declared an outlaw, but he came back to Scotland anyway. And Mary Queen of Scots had a meeting with him. She was a civil law. She won civil law rule, like some of her descendants later did. And she said, she talked to Knox and she disagreed with him and she said, my conscience is not so. And Knox said, well, madam, I believe your conscience is not right to be informed. And that's the problem. We have, juries are courts of conscience. They're not courts of law. You know, we come to court and the juries, they have to be instructed in the law. Indeed, the judge has to be, he fights with the attorneys and the attorneys tell him what they know. And nobody knows what the law is, except the poor guy who's accused. He's charged with knowledge of the law no matter what. See? So, and then you have to instruct the jury. But the jury really is a court of conscience, and they come with their conscience informed, however it's informed, and we hope it's informed aright. And if it is, then they make their own decisions. But the other thing that comes with the common law is not just knowledge, knowing what's right and what's wrong, but courage. Because, like this lady, and attorneys that go against the prosecutors or go against the public or they stand up for somebody's rights who are being violated, and everybody has a right to not have their rights violated, by the way, regardless of what they look like, how they act, or who they are, because they're made in the image of God, period, end of story. There's nothing more needs to be said. And if they're in God's image, they deserve what God says they deserve. And they may be guilty of a crime, but that doesn't mean they're to be abused. You know, Dr. Stan, even in the Bible, there was a limit to punishment, corporal punishment, of people that were convicted of crimes. And the Bible says it this way. I think a limit is when people were lashed with lashes. The Bible says that there's a limit to how many lashes you can give them, and then it says this, because, or so that, you will not despise your brother. You can beat him, but only so much, because he's a man just like you, and he has just as much dignity as you do. And as you punish him, remember that he is made in the image of God. And every person is, and they deserve that. Like the Bible says, honor all men. Honor all men. Love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Give honor to whom honor is due. And we give honor to the courts in our common law jurisdiction for important reasons, because they're the judicial branch is the branch that, as the founders said, they don't have any power. You know, our judicial branch in a common law country they make findings. What does that mean? Well, they're looking for the law. They're not making law. They're looking for it. It's out there. And our legislature, by the way, shouldn't be making law either. They should be making findings of what they believe the law are. If they're going to legislate, they must recognize also that they're not coming up with any new ideas out of whole cloth. They're not God. God knows the truth, and they're to find it also. And everybody in government, whether it's the executive, the legislative, or the judicial, their job should be to find what the truth is, not manufacture it themselves. That's what they do in civil law jurisdictions.
Well, you know, Chris, one of the things that we find when we look at the courts here, at least here in California, I suspect this is true in many, many states, that first of all, the judges were not sending people to prison who should go to prison, and so they, then the legislature enacted the minimum, sentence concept, sentencing. You had to send these people to prison for a certain period of time for the crime, irrespective of what the judge might think. And then the judges got around that. So here in California, we came up with the three strikes law. In other words, if you had three felonies, you went to prison for life. Now, a lot of that, of course, was done because the judges were letting so many criminals loose. So the legislatures, to counter what the judges were doing, took all the discretion away from the judges. And so these men, and I think that sometimes there are extenuating circumstances. Sometimes people would be, up for, a life imprisonment for a misdemeanor rather than a felony. And it would be how you would try it and what the charge would be. And so every time the legislature would try to get involved to counter the judges, why you'd get a far worse situation. Sometimes people would be sent to jail for 20 or 30 years for a drug infraction. They had some cocaine or some marijuana or something of that sort. So, and then, of course, this is why we have so many people in prison today. Most Americans don't understand that one out of every 100 adults in America is in prison. Actually, one out of every 32 adults is in prison, probation, or parole today. And certainly, as far as the blacks are concerned, one out of every three young black men between 21 and 31 is in prison, probation, and parole. This is the end result of a judicial system that has lost all concept of justice.
Oh, I agree. Go back to England. That's the roots of our law and government. But in England, even yet today, there's no legislative statute on the books, never has been, against murder. And the reason for that is that there doesn't need to be. And I don't think there needs to be any here, by the way. I think if you somebody murdered somebody and you put a jury up and they listen to the facts, they could decide whether or not he'd done the wrong thing. You don't need a piece of legislation to tell you that murder is wrong. But we do need a piece of legislation. Drug addiction, for example, or drug use, is not wrong unless the legislature says so. And just like liquor is not wrong unless the legislature says so. Well, legislature at that point is doing things that, by seems to me, aren't in the Bible. Now, clear the Bible says that we're not supposed to drink, and it's bad for us, and it destroys families and lives, and drug use, the same category, and it's even occultic in the Bible, as we know. It's part of pharmaceutical is something the Bible forbids, but I notice the Bible doesn't make that a felony to use drugs or alcohol. And our legislature has done that, and I think it's costing us a lot of money, and it's causing chaos and family problems and expense that we don't really need.
And, of course, what it's doing is enriching the drug lords and enriching the Central Intelligence Agency, which is involved with the drug smuggling. And anybody that has listened to our program knows there's all sorts of evidence to that effect. But they can't let the American people know that. And all these people sitting in prison for dealing drugs, much of it smuggled in with the full help of our own government. But, of course, we need the money for black operations. And if you doubt that, you need to read the book Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica Jensen Stevenson. We know the book's fairly accurate because, well, first of all, if we call the book here in the United States, I know that personally because I went to the bookstore and was told that the copies had been recalled. And then, of course, when they got up to Canada and they republished it, they accidentally shredded 5,000 copies of the book. Why? Because it talked about the CIA and drugs. In fact, we have a four-tape set. You will actually hear the oldest woman on the press corps there in the White House asking Bill Clinton about the drugs at MENA Airport. And he says, and you'll hear him on the four-tape set say, well, that wasn't me. I was just the governor of Arkansas. That was a federal operation. I was a federal operation. Here's the man who becomes president of the United States talking to Sarah McLennan and saying that was a federal operation. You need to understand, ladies and gentlemen, and we've got all these people sitting in prison for drug charges, and of course somebody's making an awful lot of money on it. We control Afghanistan. We're not trying to do away with the drugs over there. In fact, they've gotten the biggest crops that they've ever had since the United States.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.